For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
So I'm very happy to have with us tonight Guy Newland, who will be talking about his very fine book, A Buddhist Grief Observed. Guy is a professor of Buddhism and a practitioner in the Tibetan tradition, and a really important, helpful book about facing sadness and death and grief. So,
well, thank you very much for having me. I'm honored, and it's a joy to see the practice space that you and this community have here. We know that reality is extensive throughout space, and but there's only some places where we work together to create places to become aware of it. And I feel this is, a very beautiful opportunity in space and time that doesn't can't be taken for granted or taken lightly. I'm a scholar of Tibetan Buddhism. I was trained in the University of Virginia under Jeffrey Hopkins, and been a translator of Tibetan Buddhist philosophical texts. I've also been a Buddhist practitioner, but I'm a little bit vague about whether that's exactly in the Tibetan tradition. Usually I get invited to talk at Tibetan centers because that's what I know the most about. But I certainly don't think of myself as a Tibetan Buddhist per se because of being very American, and unlike my Tibetan friends in that regard. The book is about grief. This particular book is unlike my other books. This is my first book that I've written that was in any way truly personal. It's about grief in the sense of the difficulty that we have in facing unwanted change in our lives. And it occurred to me, thinking about that in general, that this is like a continuous process every day, that they change the software at work, or somebody redecorates things in an unpleasing way. I mean, there's always change, and sometimes we like it, but a lot of times we don't because we got used to the way things are before. So it seems to me that there's a continuum of, from micro griefs to really world-shattering loss, and there's all kinds of ways in which we're losing things all the time that we're trying to hold on to. Right, and I think that something like what we think of as stress arises from that disparity between how things are constantly slipping away and turning into something else, and the way that we would have them be, or imagine we would have them be, as something that we could grab hold of and seize upon. In my particular case, I did have experienced a world-shattering grief, and I don't think that makes me anybody special. In fact, that's exactly the point of my book, is to say that this is our shared situation, and that having been through this experience helped me to understand that in a deeper way. In 2012, my wife of 28 years, Valerie Stevens, with whom I've had two kids, grown up now, was diagnosed with metastasized breast cancer, and given a kind of vague expectation of a couple weeks to several months to live. And this was very, very difficult for our whole family to handle and to cope with. I think, I don't know, it's a general point in the book that in talking about this in Buddhist communities, you know, there is a tendency, because Buddhism focuses so much on impermanence, for us to feel that maybe we've taken death into account and fully prepared for it, or maybe we think we've more prepared for the death of our loved ones than we really are. I suppose that was true of me, and most people I've talked to, you know, who've been through world-shattering losses, did, you know, as Buddhists, have some sense of surprise that they weren't as well prepared for it as they had thought. Although they're not to say that's universal. There are a couple exceptions where people had spent a lot of time meditating daily on anticipatory grief, essentially, and expecting the loss of the people they love most, such as their teacher or their mother, or and in doing this, they had prepared themselves in a way that's extraordinary and not the usual generalized meditation on how all things pass away, which doesn't really cut all the way down to the actual attachments I have, because I don't care about things in general. I care about some very particular people, right? And if that's not what you're meditating on, I don't think you're actually getting to it. Valerie was actually sick for 13 months, and eventually she died at home. And then this, you know, creates, if you have someone die at home, maybe some of you have, you realize how unusual it is to be with a corpse, a fresh corpse. This was, you know, perhaps a more readily available experience in the Buddha's time in India, but it's often, you know, the circumstances that people find themselves in where they do have this experience. Our society seems to be organized right now to try to keep the corpses pretty well out of sight, except on very specific occasions when people can choose to be with them. But it's not really clear, you know, when you're with someone and they die, what the boundary is between life and death, and people have write articles about that, you know, and different traditions have different ideas. But yeah, you see somebody take a breath, and then there's a pause. And you don't, at that moment, actually know whether they will take another breath or not. If they do, it turns out they were alive in the preceding moments. But if they don't, right, at some point, right, we declare them dead, and then you notice the warmth start to go out of their body. So this is, you know, having this experience together with my kids in my house was, I guess I'm saying, quite different from meditating on death and impermanence in a general way. You see the fluidity between person and non-person there. That there was a person, a specific person here, and now there's an object that's referred to as a corpse, but it's like, well, when did one turn into the other? You can ask some dogmatist or, you know, who has an idea about exactly when that's supposed to have happened. But it seems something, actually, in my experience, something very slippery. And there's a transitional period where you feel like that is still the person, but it's now a new version of the person, the dead version of that person, right? And maybe there is something important in that. There's a philosopher who said that he found it comforting to think about that people he loved who'd pass away are just as real. They're just not real now. just like his friends in Tasmania are just as real but not real here. Why? And this isn't just a mental trick, I don't think, you know, playing on place, space-time continuum. It's an actual fact that we're always acting and having effects in the world, and these effects ripple down and continue. And sometimes, you know, we can think of Thomas Jefferson or Martin Luther King, and these people's Frederick Douglass comes to mind for some reason. It's getting better known. These people's actions continue to ripple, and if someone says, well, they're not real, it seems very counter to the obvious fact of the reality of their effects in the world. And we don't really know, right, how even people who are not famous, you know, in the kind things that we do or not so kind things that we do, create these kinds of ripple effects and that extend out like beyond what we can possibly imagine, or they may very well extend, you know, we will never know how much effect we've had on the universe. Yeah. So after Valerie died, I guess I had had a difficult time, and my kids had had a difficult time with that 13 months. But I thought that I guess I actually did think that her dying would bring that grief to an end. But in fact, I went into a sort of shock phase where I was. Actually had shakes like you do, like you get chills when you had the flu. My body ached as though I had the flu, and I had shaking as though I had the flu, and I felt also like I had a concussion, which I have had a concussion, so I know whereof I speak. That is that you, it's impossible to concentrate, can't sleep properly, can't read more than a couple sentences at a time, which is a little bit of a problem when you're a professor at the university, which is what my job is. So, like a long time, you know, you get so you can fake things for a while, right? But it's difficult when you can't read, and that's the big part of your job. So I don't know. Many of you may have had this experience, but you know, when you're in this shock, grief world, it's a very strange experience. Many people have written essentially the same things over and over in different words, that it's like you're in the same world with the other people in the shopping store, in the market, but you're not at the same time, and there's no way to sort of make a connection to them. And I started to feel that this had to do with the fact that I was in touch with this sort of, the really, truly, deeply painful aspect of reality that they were somehow able to ignore. That is, that there's a huge conspiracy of denial that operates. We keep all the dying people on one floor of the hospital where, you know, they don't get mixed up with the other people who aren't dying, and people don't have to see them all the time. And so that we have all kinds of activities that we use to distract ourselves from facing reality and the sense of loss that goes along with seeing things as they are, which is that they're constantly slipping away. I mean, when we teach about how things are in Buddhism, you can start by telling people things like, well, you know, there'll be a time when the United States doesn't exist. And they're like, oh, really? I never thought of that, but I guess that would be true, maybe, maybe not, you know? And then some people will want to argue with you about the eternal nature of the United States, or you know, Mount Everest isn't always going to be around. And like whatever it is that they think is really solid, and you can point out how it has come together based on causes and conditions, and it will, even if it seems like it won't, it will actually pass away sometime. And then when people get used to that, you can say, well, If it's going to pass away sometime, maybe it's already starting to pass away a little bit at a time right now. And that's harder for people to get their heads around and think that, Mount Everest is transitory in the way a flame is flickering there on the altar, or, the way the water is when it's rushing in the river. It's just that we don't see the change in the way we do with fire and water. But it's constantly, everything's changing instant by instant. And then when people say, now I understand that things are really changing, then the question becomes, what are these things that are changing? If it, Alice in Wonderland has this great line that Lewis Carroll has about Alice falls down the rabbit hole and she thinks, maybe I've changed in the night. But if I did, I hope I haven't turned into, my friend Molly or whatever her name was, because she doesn't really want to become that person, right? And we're just always slipping away from ourselves and then working to maintain this sense that there's something stable and continuous there. And if you look at pictures of ourselves from enough decades back, then it's possible to get a sense that, who's that kid, right? At some point, it's if that's really you, then how come you don't know yourself anymore? Well, gradually over time, back at work, people would give me things to do and make me feel useful, and I would start to feel a little less bad. And because I had been going out and giving Dharma talks, one particular group of friends was after me to go and give Dharma talks. And I told them that I couldn't concentrate or read. Usually I talk about emptiness, the ultimate nature of reality is ungraspable. And I said, I don't really think I can talk about that. But so then I went and I talked about grief and loss and this idea of fundamentally facing up to not knowing, being open to the idea that we don't know, rather than trying to grasp onto some idea or knowledge. And that this can be really liberating, and liberating in a way that enables us to be more helpful to others. And so I went and started giving talks along those lines, and telling the story that I told about losing my wife, and something else surprising to me happened, which is that because I was bearing my soul, I guess is the cliche, or just opening my heart to people in this way, other people started coming up to me and doing the same and telling me about things that were deeply distressing or had been traumatic in their lives. And that hadn't happened to me before in my previous teaching experiences. And I was, I was a little bit surprised at first, because I thought, well, I've come here to talk about my experience, not to hear about all your difficulties. That was my first thought, honestly. And then I realized that was really the whole point, that it wasn't just my private experience, that this is a sort of blunt force encounter with the First Noble Truth is something that connects us to one another. And it feels the opposite, like when you're in grief shock land, you feel like you're trapped alone in an alternative dimension that's wrapped up right inside this one, but can never quite touch where the other people are, and the other people can't touch where you are. But actually, everybody has these experiences of loss and trauma in their lives. And so I feel like it's really important when we have this kind of experience to remember it and stay in touch with it, right? And not lose track of how it creates this kinship between us, that we're all together in this pain family, and that's how a kind of liberation from the denial that's creating needless layers of suffering and anxiety on top of the pain that's a necessary part of being a being with the body. I'm just talking about things that are in the book without going in any particular order. One of the things that comes up, because in my tradition, the tradition that I mainly studied and practice in Tibetan Buddhist tradition, there's a lot of emphasis on the idea that everything that people experience is the result of their past actions, and that nobody gets the consequences of other people's past actions. It may appear that they do, but actually anything that happens to them, good or bad, is the consequences of their own past actions in past lives. And I've never been comfortable with that understanding of karma. I started thinking about, it's always described in terms of planting seeds. And, you know, you plant seeds, and then if you plant, you know, just as you sow, so shall you reap, essentially. If you plant good karmic seeds, you'll have good karmic fruit. And but then I started to feel that, like, well, my way of thinking about the world, our way of thinking about the world, is more about waves and the interactions of waves and probability waves. And there's no, like, this kind of, like, if you plant this seed, then X will absolutely definitely happen. If you make a big wave, it could be hit by a blast of wind, or it could hit another wave that's coming across. And there's all kinds of things that can happen in the complexity of the world as it actually is. And then I realized that even if you take the traditional example of planting a seed and you go back, and because everybody was, you know, growing food and understood agricultural metaphors, but farmers don't always get what they sow either. Sometimes they get a big hailstorm, right? And sometimes they get, like, some corn blight. And there's all kinds of things that can happen. Even if they planted the very best seeds and did the very best they could to help those seeds grow. That's the way the world actually is. All the time. And that the things that we do make a difference, and we can never know how far that difference may extend or echo into the future. But on the other hand, they're going forth into a world where they're constant, these actions are constantly, effects of these actions are rippling and cross-rippling with all the choices that everybody else is making, right? And so you can't actually control any outcome in the way that some traditional interpretations of karma seem to suggest. So it's hard for people to, in general, it seems that a great many people would rather feel guilty than to acknowledge that they don't have total control over their fate. They'd rather feel, well, there's something different I could have done and will do different the next time to make sure it all comes out okay. And a lot of religion seems to work that way to me. If you do the ritual right, you'll get the rain that you want. You didn't do it right. That's why it didn't rain. You know. You did the right action, but your heart wasn't pure. Right? And so forth. And so there's always, like, a way to understand that, like, oh, your actions are really important, but somehow they weren't right, just right, and that's why you didn't get what you... Well, it could be that another answer is that there's lots of other people making different choices that are interacting with yours so that you don't actually have the ability to control anything. Even the things that you care about the most, and this is the point, like, I would... You know, I'm very clear and say, like, I would rather have been the person who was dying than that my wife was dying. But that wasn't in my control, right? If there was anything I could have done to help her live, I would have done it. But there actually wasn't anything. To face up to reality means facing up to that that the fact that our choices matter and that that is our path to make the best choices we can does not mean that we have control over any outcomes. The practice, I think, is to do the very best that we can, moment by moment, with fullest attention, without thinking that that guarantees anything except that moment being the best that it can be. It's difficult to do that. I think a lot of people are looking for some sort of consolation in religion or security blanket that way of looking at things doesn't give. And by a lot of people, I don't mean just like, you know, non-Buddhists. I mean Buddhists, all people, everybody, you know, is looking for something a little bit. Not everybody, but most people, in my experience, seem to want something a little bit more of a safety net in their universe or more justice built into the structure of it than that. So it's hard to face up to that. But I think that that's what honesty entails, like that honesty means looking at reality as nakedly as we can manage. And that's how I see the world when I look at it that way. In the book, I talk a little bit about how I saw raising children together with Valerie as a spiritual practice. Valerie was not a Buddhist. She knew a lot about Buddhism. And she was a psychotherapist. She, like most psychotherapists these days, used techniques from Buddhism in her practice. But she wasn't a Buddhist. And our agreement, basically, in raising kids together was that our common values were honesty and kindness. And we may have had slightly different ways of interpreting these, but not very different. And my understanding of honesty it was a way of talking in non-Buddhist-sounding language about wisdom, the kind of clarity of seeing things directly as we can, as purely as we can, to see how things are. And that means, like, you know, knowing yourself, trying to understanding your own motivations and what's going on with yourself, and then looking clearly at the pain that you have, right, and how that's affecting you, and looking at what's around you, and in being honest about what's in the room with you, who's there with you, not imposing, like, because people are afraid, right, in dealing with people who are grieving or dying, right, then they equip themselves with some schema or maps of theories, you know. I hate to beat up on Kubler-Ross again, but anyway, that's like that's just exemplifies what I mean, right? That this is, you can take, you know, somebody and say, here are the things to watch out for, and then they feel less afraid because they know they're going to be these five things. and then they have like a map. But the problem is that people don't actually know. These are very rough maps that are just made up, you know, provisionally. And you have to start by knowing that you really don't know, you know, what's there in the room, rather than trying to impose something on people. And so I think that that's, in other words, I see a connection between honesty and what, you know, in the Tibetan tradition we call wisdom, and what is also called don't know mind. It's this mind of like openness or receptiveness that makes it possible to become attuned to other people when you're together with them. I'm not saying that I'm particularly good at this, by the way. I'm just saying that's my idea about what people should be like. Yeah. I don't know. Some people are very good at it. And if you can be very attuned to the other people that you're trying to help, and not impose a grid a priori on what they're supposed to be feeling, right, or what's supposed to be helpful, then you don't need to be equipped going into the room with the magic words. Because there aren't any, right? Just need to be there. And, right? And see what comes up. Maybe being silent is better. And maybe it's sometimes the worst thing. But you don't know, right? Until you're really there. As for kindness, obviously, that's the compassion side of the, for me, you know, and it's active compassion, not just a feeling, right? But doing what we can genuinely to help others. And it works together with honesty or what I'm called, wisdom, in that, you know, when you want to be kind, when you want to try to figure out how to help people, it motivates you to try to understand more about, to pay more attention, right? To see, kindness supports honesty because it motivates you to look more closely at what's really happening. I don't know. I have some disagreements with some friends of mine, I guess you could call them mystics, who feel that, you know, the core of religion is these like extraordinary and indescribable experiences, which, you know, get chalked up as the kingdom of heaven or samsara and nirvana as a non-dual. And it's clear, right, that this is a thing. But some people who have experiences like this aren't necessarily very helpful or kind to other people. And some people are super kind and helpful to other people and never have an experience like that. So, you know, I guess you have to choose what you think is really important and makes life worthwhile. Getting a good buzz on or, you know, trying to be helpful. I think it's a choice for me. I guess I can acknowledge other people have their own choices, but I agree with William James, you know, who said that the one of the key qualities that distinguishes a religious experience is that it leads to your becoming a better person. That you become kinder and more helpful to others. And the Dalai Lama has said this too, you know, that his religion is kindness, and that if your practice over time isn't helping you in the direction of being at least less cruel and hopefully, you know, more kind, then maybe you're doing something wrong. You know, that's actually what I would say, but of course people can make their own choices about what they want to get out of their experience. It's just to say my own point of view is like, if you really want to, you know, have ecstasy as quickly as possible, there are chemical alternatives. You don't necessarily have to go to all this trouble of sitting so straight for long periods of time. And if you're going to do this kind of work, maybe it's because you're trying to do something other than get really high. You know? You think so?
Yes.
Yeah. A further thing that's in my book, I'll say a couple more things, is talking about death. So I am, before I wrote the grief book, I was kind of seen as like a person to invite to Tibetan Dharma centers to talk about emptiness or the relationship between ultimate reality and conventional reality. It's kind of a philosophical Tibetan Buddhist based, talker. Yeah. And, so it was very natural when I started doing this kind of thing that people said, well, how did empty knowing so much about emptiness, if that's the right way to put it, help you with your grief? And I want to be clear that I'm not going to say that it didn't help me at all. But at first, that was definitely my impulse, is to say that. People seem to think that because I had studied emptiness and written about emptiness and had, at least at the intellectual level, a clear understanding, you know, of certain explanant ways of talking about emptiness, that this would somehow prepare me better, you know, to lose my wife, or that it, I don't know. I feel like people actually think, well, emptiness would be like a good eraser. Do you see what I'm saying? Like an eraser. Yeah, it's up there on the board, but it's erased. It's been placed under erasure, is the, you know, postmodernists would say. And it didn't seem like that to me. I don't think that's actually the middle way, but, you know, who knows. But it doesn't seem like that to me. I felt like that Valerie was alive, and now Valerie's dead, and that if you thought that emptiness made that untrue, that you were overstating what emptiness was about. It isn't really a matter of canceling out facts. And these facts are hard facts, right? It's hard emotionally to face those facts. And I'm reminded of, you know, C.S. Lewis, because he wrote, you know, he's like a, I don't know, wisdom people help me steal the title idea. But it's really right, because C.S. Lewis wrote all these books like of dogmatic Christian apologetics, and then he had this terrible grief experience. And when he wrote A Grief Observed, he did not write it from the point of view of Christian dogma. He talked about, "Whoa, as a Christian, I can believe perfectly well that I'm going to meet my true love again in heaven." But that's not what I want. I want her back here now. And it doesn't really... So he was able to... And I feel like it's parallel emotionally for me. I think that we're human beings. And it's in the nature of human beings to form relationships with other human beings. And that in these relationships... there's an element of attachment that develops. And to have attachment means to have pain and the loss when these attachments are broken. I'm not saying that it's impossible to get into a condition where you isolate yourself from any possibility of pain by having no attachments whatsoever. I guess I'm just raising the question of whether that's really what we want to do or not. I think it is to be. It sort of suggests becoming inhuman or trans. You know, is the Buddha human or not human? That's an interesting question. Are we trying to stop being human or not? Because I think that being human in a full sense involves forming healthy attachments and then having some sense of loss when they're broken, which they will be one way or the other. You know, they were broken for Valerie when she had to anticipate, you know, no longer being with their kids as they finished growing up, right? And I guess I feel that honesty, as a Buddhist, calls me to say that that's the way things are. That's the liberation that I would find within practice is opening my heart fully to accept that, the reality of that pain, and to see how it connects us to one another rather than feeling isolated and alone because I'm the only one who has this weird pain that nobody else understands, which honestly does sort of reflect where I started out, you know. So, you know, everybody knows, maybe, I don't know, I won't assume what everybody knows, but a super famous story, right, about Kisa Gotami in the Buddhist tradition. There are different versions of it, actually, but in some sense, she's like the Buddhist Job. She has a lot of bad things happen to her in one story. In one story, you know, she's from a poor family. Her name means skinny, you know, and then she marries a higher status man, is looked at with scorn by her in-laws, but she's, you know, the big goal is to produce a male heir for the family, and she has a son. She's very much in love with her son, and also it makes her a real person in the eyes of her family that she's married into. And then this little boy, like, not so many things that could go wrong, right? No antibiotics or anything, right? But he just apparently just falls and, you know, has a playground accident, essentially, and dies, right? And it's just like out of the blue. Suddenly she doesn't have this son anymore, and she can't see that at all. So she carries the body around asking people for medicine to help him get better. And they can see that he's dead, and I'm imagining that they're pretty horrified. You know, like, we probably wouldn't enjoy it if people came up to our door with a corpse and said, you know, can you help me out with this corpse, bringing it back to life? And I think in India it would be much worse, because this is like a monumental source of pollution. Nobody wants this, you know, someone else's corpse coming to their door. So one man sends her, you know, say, well, maybe the Buddha's very wise, maybe he can help you. And so he sends her over to the Buddha, and the Buddha says, well, I can help you, but in order to do so, I need to have, you know, mustard seed. Oh, yeah, and the mustard seed has to come from a house that hasn't, you know, had a death in the family, haven't suffered a terrible loss. So she goes through the town door to door, and we don't get the blow by blow on what this happens, but it dawned on me in doing this that it's very clear that if she went door to door asking people for mustard seed and saying, oh yeah, by the way, has anything terrible happened in your family, that maybe, what do you say, a third of the people or half of the people, some percentage of the people would tell her the story, just like what happened to me. You know, I had, you know, people tell me about really horrible, tragic things that had happened to them, and I couldn't help but feel, almost against my will of self-pity, empathy for them. And that's what happened to her, to Kisa Gotami. I think this is not actually written this way in the sutta, but it's like she talked to so many people who told her so many terrible stories that it just burnt out her psychotic grief, right? And by the end of the day, she's seeing the whole town, you know, as woven together of one fabric. Herself as part, you know, one with all these people, not apart from them anymore. I feel that something like this happened to me in the summer of 2014 when I started giving talks like this, and it I don't say in an instant or anything like that, but over a period of a week or so, hearing other people's stories of loss really changed my mind. And I no longer had this idea that, like, how the heck did these people out here in the world not, you know, just go on with their lives, not understanding, you know, the horror of what's just happened? Because it comes clear that they all have their own horrors, or if they don't, and a few people don't, right, they will pretty soon, right? And that we're all, you know, at some level, in some degree, you know, post-traumatic, except for a few lucky people who are still pre-traumatic. But even those of us who are post-traumatic are also probably still pre-traumatic as well. And that this is like what this understanding this and not allowing our pain to isolate us from other people, but recognizing it as our as threads that tie us together with kindness and compassion, was it changed my mind in a way that made me feel like that I was in the lineage of Kisa Gotami in a minor way. Let me put it like that. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So we have a little bit of time for comments, responses, questions. Thank you very much, Guy. And, just to comment, we yesterday had our Paranirvana ceremony for the passing away of Shakyamuni. And we still have
the statue. The
statue of the Buddha passing away, so even the Buddha. So, comments, questions? Guy, please.
Yes. Thank you.
One thing it has in it is lots of references of other important things that would be valuable to read. But I wanted to just ask you, one of the chapters that struck me so much that I keep thinking about, it's like, what can I work on in this regard? You told several stories of friends of yours trying to be helpful to you and your children and being so clumsy and unskillful about it, not talking, inviting you to dinner and then not talking about it and just avoiding it completely.
Yeah.
And I thought we can help develop our own skillful means in this regard. I just wonder if you have advice for us.
Yeah, that's right. In the last chapter, I tried to... I had some sense that some people who were sincerely trying to be helpful actually were exacerbating my pain and my kids' pain at some points. And that at the time that this was happening, I was frankly angry about it and not very understanding of the sincerity of their good intentions and so forth, because it was so counterproductive for us. Like the idea of people who are you know, doing us a favor by not acknowledging, to say the elephant in the room is to understate it, you know? We're just like totally in shock, and people just are uncomfortable talking about it, and then they justify their not talking about it as being an act of compassion towards us. I found that very difficult, like, to take. And it took me a while to realize that even these people who did some things that I feel like were exacerbating my pain, that from their own point of view, in terms of their own family traditions and their own understanding of how psychology works, they were actually all trying to be helpful. And it's true. And over time, I've become more and more understanding and forgiving, and also I may be even a little regretful about some of my anger towards these people at the time. But so what can we do when someone close to us is grieving? So the most important thing, I think, is to not act as though nothing has happened. That is like thinking that by bringing it up, you're making the situation worse. I mean, you have these two awkward things, to bring it up, the most painful topic, or to not bring it up, right? And I think in general, you know, it depends on your relationship with the person, but in general, to act as though nothing's happened, right, is worse, in my opinion. For most people think that, right? So what you do depends on the situation, you know? You send a condolence card. I got a lot of condolence cards, and I say in the book that I thought at the time that they were all pretty much useless, with a few exceptions, and that is ones where people opened their hearts to me and told me stories about their loss. It touched me. And the other ones, I didn't feel that they meant anything to me until much later. And then I realized that if nobody sent any cards or said anything about it, that would have been much, much worse. Much worse. And so, you know, just sending somebody a note or a card isn't going to make it okay. That's not on the board. You know, it's like acknowledging that something important has happened to them is better than not acknowledging it. And, you know, you have to see, like, what the context of the relationship is and what a particular person needs at a particular time. I found that talking to people who have some common kind of experience was helpful to me. And I've thought about this, you know, it's like, it's not just this. I mean, many people have worse things, many much worse things happen in their lives. And they will say, well, you know, there's no way a guy can understand. And they're right, right? It's like there's different kinds of traumatic loss. And if you can find people who have experiences that really resonate with you, and right, and then have that community of shared experience, I think that can be really helpful in healing, because you get a sense of it being normal to feel really bad, right? And then you don't, like, I don't know, if in our culture anyway, people feel that it's bad to feel really bad, and then they feel bad about how bad they feel. And then maybe they feel bad about that too. I'm not really sure. I don't go there. But they definitely feel bad about feeling bad. And they feel less bad about feeling bad if it's like made okay to feel really bad when something really bad's happened to you. And that's, you know, if someone says, oh yeah, my cat died, that's not going to be helpful, right, to someone who's just lost a... But not that that's not... I'm not saying that's trivial. It's just that those people have to have their group. Like, I'm not going to go to the combat veterans who have lost limbs or have traumatic head injuries, you know, and start... Do you see what I'm saying? It's like there's all different kinds of things. I had this particular experience in it. I could observe, you know, with some mindfulness practice, how strange it made my way of thinking, that I didn't want to talk to a therapist unless I knew his wife had died. I wanted to hire a certain lawyer because his wife had died. And I was like, I'm not sure that makes very much sense, but I can see how my mind is working there, you know, and it's like I'm finding this little community. And first, the initial community is very, very small. Yeah. So I think not everybody can be equally helpful. If you have like an experience that's will be recognized by the other person as being as grave or graver than theirs, then you can open your heart to them perhaps in a way that's helpful. Some people have told me that it's really helpful to have someone who's just willing to sit with them and not talk. Not try to make them talk. Joan Halifax talks about this use of silence. You know, we have, I don't know if anybody's read the Vimalakirti Nirdesha Sutra, but if you haven't, it's a great read, probably one of the few really funny Buddhist scriptures. Maybe the only, no, well, I won't say the only one. But it's, as far as Buddhist scriptures from India, is probably the only really funny one. And, In there is this very careful use of speech and silence. And it's not that speech is good and silence is bad or vice versa. It's how you do it. And that's why I was trying to talk about attunement, not having the idea ahead of time that silence will be good and I will go in there and be silent. Do you see what I'm saying? It's like, but silence is definitely a possibility, just being with somebody and seeing if there's a moment when they might seem receptive to talking. There is some evidence, actually, in, you know, studies and so forth, that a certain percentage of people do benefit over time from telling and retelling their story of what's happened to them. Apparently, it isn't everybody. People are different, right? But there is, you know, research on that. And so if you can create a context in which a person feels comfortable beginning to tell the story, I think that that's a step in the right direction. Yeah.
I want to allow space to continue this discussion, but I also want to
make sure there's time for people to purchase this book, because it's really a helpful book. So maybe we'll just one more comment, if anyone has a comment or question. Yes, Bill.
I wanted to say that I was surprised at how universally written it was. And I say that in the sense that I picked the book up because I just lost my son. So when I looked at it, I said, how much can I actually identify with? Because you lost a spouse.
Exactly.
But I was amazed at how much of myself I saw in the book that you had written about your spouse. And the response and reaction of friends and the whole process. So it's really a book that no matter what the grief is, you will find yourself in there.
Thank you, Billy.